"You people of Weisei," he said to Joseph's attendants, "can now be off and set out on your homeward journey. You will be going upstream, and you will have a north wind. Take your rope along with you, and make my compliments to Pharaoh's friend, your master. Meni," he gave order in conclusion to the man with the club, who had ushered in the new arrival, "this slave of the king will do convict labor as assistant in the office. Show him a place to sleep by himself, and give him an upper garment and a staff of office. Very high he once stood, very low he has let himself be brought down here to us. Now he must submit to the iron regimen of Zawi Rei. What superior parts he brings with him, we will ruthlessly exploit, just as we do the physical strength of the lower sort. For they belong no longer to himself, but to Pharaoh. Give him something to eat. Till our next meeting, father." He took leave of the chaplain and turned back to his tower. Such was Joseph's first meeting with Mai Sakme, the governor of the prison. Of Goodness and Cleverness. Now, like Joseph himself, you are reassured as to the particular kind of man this governor was, into whose hands Petipre had given him. He was a man of peculiarly even and pleasing temper, and not for nothing has our all-illuminating narrative been in so little haste to take the spotlight from his undeniably stoutish figure, but has let it rest long enough upon him for the reader to get a clear picture of his hitherto unknown personality. And this, for the reason that he has a not insignificant part, again very little known, to play in the tale which is here being retold with all possible correctness and verisimilitude. The fact is that after Mai Sakme had been Joseph's superior and taskmaster for some years, he continued for a long time at his side, and bore a part in the stage management of great and glorious events, as we shall soon hear. And may the muses strengthen me in the task of narration. All this only in passing. But in speaking of the governor of the prison, the tradition uses the same formula earlier applied to Potiphar, that he took nothing on himself, so that Joseph was soon responsible for all that happened in his second pit. We must pause upon this tradition to interpret it aright, for it has not at all the meaning it had in the case of the sun courtier and consecrated mountain of flesh who took nothing on himself simply because his whole being was nominal and titular, because he stood outside humanity, and in a straitness of existence without prospect of change, remote from reality, an existence of the purest form, whereas Mai Sakme was a perfectly competent man, warmly if placidly interested in any number of things, particularly in people. He was a sedulous physician who rose early every morning to inspect the discharge of the soldiers and convicts in his sick bay. His workroom, in a well-guarded spot in the citadel tower of Zawi Rei, was a perfect laboratory, equipped with a herbarium, with mortars and pestles, phials and ointment pots, tubes and stills. Here, that same shrewd, sleepy face he had worn when on the first day he told the story of the three love affairs, bent over lotions, pills, and poultices, or consulted the work for the benefit of mankind and other textbooks of ripe wisdom for advice on the treatment of retention of urine, tumors of the neck, spinal rigidity, heartburn, and the like. As he read and pondered, his mind ranged over a whole area of general speculations. Were the blood vessels that ran in pairs from the heart to the separate limbs of the body, and were so prone to hardening, choking, and inflammation that they often would not respond to treatment, were there only 22 of these blood vessels, or 46, as he was more and more inclined to think? Were the worms in the body, to whose destruction he applied his electuaries, the cause of certain illnesses, or, more correctly, their result? For instance, by the stopping up of one or more vessels, a tumor was formed, which had no outlet to discharge by, and eventually became putrid, and of course turned into worms. It was a good thing the captain took these matters on himself, although, as a soldier, they were less his province than that of his partner at drafts, the priest of Wepwawet. but the latter's knowledge of such physical matters was confined to the inspection and ritual slaughtering of the sacrificial animals, and his methods of healing were too dependent on charms and phylacteries, though, of course, these too were useful in their place, certainly in a case where the affection of an organ, say the spleen or the spinal column, was clearly due to the fact that its special protecting deity had forsaken that member and left it to a hostile demon who was now creating his disturbing effect therein and must be forced by suitable invocations to void the field. For this purpose, the chaplain had a cobra which he kept in a basket and by pressure on the neck could turn into a magic wand. His successes with the cobra sometimes inspired my Sakme to borrow the creature, but on the whole, the governor had the settled conviction that just magic by itself as a sufficing principle was seldom able to pull it off. It needed to be permeated and propped up by the grosser methods of profane knowledge, through which then it could produce its effect. For instance, Zawi Ray had suffered from a plague of fleas, and the charms of the man of God had never reduced it, or so temporarily that the relief might have been only self-deception. It was only when my Sakme, of course to the accompaniment of the spoken text, had sprinkled much natron water and strewn much charcoal mixed with the powdered herb baybet that the pest subsided. It was the governor who ordered the lids of the food stocks in the storehouses to be smeared with cat fat, the mice being almost as much of a nuisance as the fleas. He had reckoned that the creatures would be frightened, thinking they were smelling the cat itself, and would leave the supplies alone, which proved to be the case. Prison put all the prisoners into his hand. When he went out to the quarries, it was as a sort of upper inspector and immediate representative of the commandant, and the improvement became general. For Joseph had in mind Jacob, his far-off father, to whom he was as dead, and how he had always disapproved of the Egyptian house of bondage. He decreed that a man, even after falling down only twice, should fall out and be fetched back to the island. For the first time he fell, continued to be reckoned a sham, unless, of course, the man was dead. So the lazarette was never empty of those who wreathed and writhed. A man might have broken a bone, or could no longer look down upon his belly, or his body might be covered with great swellings from infected fly and gnat bites, or his stomach, when one put one's finger on it, might go up and down like oil in a leather bottle, or stone dust might cause inflammation and running from the eyes. All these cases the captain dealt with, shrinking from none, and for each, if the man was not already dead, he knew a remedy. The broken bones he splinted with little pieces of board. The inability of a man to look down upon his belly he sought to control with soothing poultices. The purulent discharge from bites he painted with goose grease mixed with an emollient powdered herb. For the bloated abdomen, he prescribed a chewing of berries of the castor oil plant with beer, and for the frequent eye inflammations he had a good salve from Byblus. Probably there was always a trifle of magic to help out the medicines and defeat the insidious demon, but it consisted not so much in texts for application of the cobra wand as in the emanation from Mysakme's imperturbable personality, which worked wonders of soothing on the patient, so that he was no longer frightened by his illness, that always having a bad effect. He ceased to writhe, and unconsciously put on the captain's own facial expression, the rounded open lips, the brows drawn up with almost a quizzical air. So the patient lay and looked with equanimity towards healing or death. For this, too, my Sakme taught them by his own attitude not to be afraid, and even when a man's face was already corpse color, his hands, in their relaxed pose, still expressed his doctor's teaching. Quietly, comprehendingly, with lifted brows and parted lips, he lay, looking forward to the life after death. So the lazarette was pervaded by serenity and absence of fear. Joseph sometimes entered it as the governor's right hand, and even lent a hand, for he was soon transferred from the quarry to inside service. The words, "The governor of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners that were in the prison, and whatsoever they did there, he was the doer of it," are to be understood as meaning that Potiphar's former house steward, some 6 months after he entered Zawi Ray, had become, without any special title or promotion, the head manager and provisioner of the whole fortress. All the records and accounts went through his hands, and these, as everywhere else in the country, were endless. All purchases of oil, corn, barley, and cattle, all the giving out of supplies to the guards and convicts, all the operations in the brewery and the bakery of Zawi Ray, even the income and outgo of the Wepwawet Temple, all matters connected with the dispatch of hewn stone from the quarries, and much, much else besides, came to be Joseph's business, greatly to the relief of those who had had charge of it before. He was accountable to the governor only, to that easy-going man with whom, from the very beginning, he had got on so well and continued to get on better and better. For my Sakme had learned that the words in which Joseph answered him at the first hearing had been uttered in very truth, the ancient, dramatic formula of self-revelation, which had startled his phlegmatic soul and made him aware that the end of his nose had got cold. The impression had been uncommon, also very vague and general in kind. The captain was, in a way, grateful to Joseph for it, for on its basis he felt justified in his craving to be stirred out of his phlegm, and he looked forward to a satisfaction of the craving just as he did to the reappearance of the maiden Nekhbet in her grandchild and the ensuing third set of emotions, though he modestly and shrewdly sized himself up as not worthy of such a shock. Vague and undefined, too, was my Sakme's feeling that Joseph had uttered the truth in his self-revelation. He could not have said what was meant by the he in the always portentous formula, I am he. He did not even know that he would not have known what it meant, because he had never found it desirable or necessary to consider the point. That is the difference between his obligations and ours. My Sakme, in his time, which was early from one point of view, though from another also very late, must be entirely absolved from any such responsibility. He may be allowed to go his placid way and limit himself, though with a modicum of trepidation, to feeling, faith, and divination. Our source has it that the Lord was with Joseph and gave him to find favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. This "and" might be interpreted to mean that the favor which God showed to the son of Rachel consisted precisely in the kindliness his taskmaster conceived for him. But favor and kindliness are not precisely the same thing. It was not that God showed to Joseph the favor of making the captain's mind favorable to him. The sympathy and confidence, in a word, the trust, which Joseph's appearance and behavior inspired in the prison keeper, flowed rather from the unerring instinct of a good man for the divine favor, that is, for the divine itself, which rested upon this convict's head. For it is indeed the mark of a good man that he is wise enough to perceive and reverence the divine. Here, goodness and wisdom lie so close together that they actually seem to be the same.